Welcome to another episode of GEQ Speaks, your go-to platform for insightful conversations, captivating stories, and thought-provoking discussions. GEQ is a series of experiences, and we're just making sense of that as we go along. That is what we're doing here, one conversation at a time. So sit back, relax, and let's dive into our episode.
Welcome to GEQ Speaks. My name is Aya Ahmed, and with me is Noon Al Sharif, class of 2027. And what brings us here today is to talk about our homeland, Sudan, and to sort of focus on the humanitarian crisis within the political stance in what is going right now in Sudan. And I would like to first start this conversation by talking about the pre-war in Sudan, or what happened before the war in Sudan, since we consider it right now as sort of a butterfly effect for what is currently happening in the country. So I'm giving the floor to Noon right now to let us know about the background of the war in Sudan.
Yeah, so I think you can also speak to that because you were in Sudan for a very long time as well. But I was living in Sudan ever since I was a child, and actually I left Sudan in 2022 and moved here. So I think I know a lot about like what life was like in the years leading up to the revolution, 2018, 2019. Life was getting very difficult, not in terms of just like housing a lot of homeless people and the decline in the economy, but also in terms of just people trying to afford living, you know, trying to afford food. And I think the one thing that really struck hard, like made it very difficult for people to live, is the bread. Because as you know, like bread is one of the most important things in when we're talking about Sudanese cuisine. Everybody eats bread, and we have this sort of like pastry places all over the country. And so when the flour prices get expensive, the bread also gets expensive, and it gets very difficult for people to afford to eat like their normal meals every day. And I think that that's the one thing I remember in terms of like before the revolution, what was happening is people couldn't afford to buy bread. And so it became very difficult for them to, you know, sustain their lives, and people also couldn't find jobs. And just like in general, the economy was declining. And it was very difficult for people to live under the regime of Omar al-Bashir. And I think this is a good segue kind of to get us into this, because Sudan was ruled by a dictator for more than 30 years. And his name was Omar al-Bashir. He was an army general who took power in a military coup. And he kind of was just remained the dictator of the country for a very long time. And I think the way that he managed to stay in power is that he made sure that the economy was at least just like above surface. People were not struggling that much at that time when we're talking about like Khartoum, the capital of the country. So people afforded to live, you know, but in the years leading up to the coup where he was overthrown, it was just very difficult for people to live, and they got fed up with it. So now I think we can transition to talk about the revolution. Do you want to go into that?
So when the revolution started, I came to Sudan to fully like start my high school education there. And I remember it was December 2018. And it started from Atbara, which is a different state than Khartoum, where someone decided to protest in the street saying, why is bread that expensive? This is a primary good and it's becoming really expensive. Inflation is going to go crazy. And the revolution started from Atbara, and then it moved or transitioned to Khartoum and different parts of Sudan. And then it started to become embedded in the lifestyle of Sudanese people. And it even got into the level where it has a schedule. People have a schedule to go out on the street, and they decide when to have like a million numbered, let's say, revolution, where we trying to get every single house in Sudan to go out in the street and protest. And it was going that way. And although it was a fully 100% peaceful revolution, it was faced by aggression from every single force that you can ever think of in Sudan, considering RSF, the army, the Security Council, of these forces were standing completely against the revolution. However, people still were determined to continue going on. So the revolution continued being successful until April 6th, 2019. People, again, in the schedule announced that we want to have a million people revolution or a protest. And while the people were protesting on the street, they have decided that they want to aim or head towards the military headquarters in the center of the Khartoum.
And I think one of the reasons is because some officials from the military told them, if you can gather enough people and come to the military headquarters and demand for us to overthrow the dictator, we're going to overthrow the dictator.
Yeah.
And so you had millions upon millions of people. The numbers on Google are going to tell you like 1 million or 2 million, but it was much more than that.
Yeah.
It was, they were covering the streets, the cars, the road was blocked for like 2 months after that.
I remember it was pretty much a celebratory day. People were so happy because they finally successfully managed to, they managed to be there and be protected by the military. Unfortunately, not fully, because I remember on that day, a few hours after they announced that protesters are safe, me and my mom and my sister decided to go out as well. And when we were involved in a group that we're heading to the headquarters, we got one of the Security Council forces came and they started to shoot. We don't know what they were shooting. I don't know if they were shooting sound bombs. I don't know if they were shooting guns. And we were primarily like close from where the headquarters were, but they were attacking.
They were attacking
civilians. But when we managed to get in the car and go to the headquarters itself, it was more sort of safer. And
I think the whole point about it was that if you stay, I stay.
Yeah.
They can't kill us all. So let's all stand together. Please don't leave. And I think my brother told me about this because he was there.
Yeah.
He told me he was one of the people who was standing at the kind of border of the whole protest. And whenever someone leaves, they're like, stand with us. They can't kill us all. Just stay, sleep here. We'll get you food. We'll get you whatever you want. And that's how it lasted for like a very long time. You know, months upon months, you had people coming into this peaceful sit-in. It wasn't a protest anymore. It was a sit-in where people were sleeping, eating, like while striving for political change.
And it was such a beautiful moment of unity in Sudan, because you get to see trains, buses coming from different states carrying thousands of people just to come and join the set-in. And a lot of charity was also happening in there. People cook food and they take it to over there. People sleep over.
Yeah.
People eat. And a lot of services were done for free. Even countries like Qatar, they used to bring charity over there. Food, drinks, all of that, for just to support this moment of unity in Sudan.
This is the part about that makes me sad.
Yes, unfortunately.
My brother told me something. He told me he was there. And, you know, in Sudan at that time, we had a homelessness issue.
Yes.
And he told me this kid walked up to him and he was like, well, I don't want this to end. And he was like, why don't you want this to end? He was like, I was homeless and I feel like I found a home now. Please don't go. Like, please make them continue to do this. And he was like, but the dictator was overthrown. What are we still going to do here? He's like, I just want a home like this.
Yeah. And it appears that after Omar al-Bashir was overthrown, the sit-in was still continuing.
Mm.
But then, unfortunately, not for too long. Because in June, there was the massacre of the sit-in. And I remember it was a few days before Eid, which is a day where people are supposed to be happy. But they turn it to this depressive point in every Sudanese person's life, whether if they were in Sudan or whether they were outside. And simply, what happened in actual terms is that any force that you can think of, but primarily the rapid support forces, were massacring every single human being that was there in the set-in. I'm talking children, women, men, every single person that was over there. They were getting killed. They were getting tortured. Their bodies are getting thrown in trucks and taken to get thrown in the river or whatever in some big hall, as if these people were not just over there celebrating in front of you. And you, as a soldier with a gun, you just decide to go ahead and massacre whatever you see in front of you because you received some orders to kill millions of people, millions of Sudanese people that are in the same place.
It's a very dark day in Sudanese history, and I think, like, everyone remembers that day. And I wasn't personally in Sudan at that time, but I remember, like, we were trying to figure out what was happening to the people we know who were there.
Yeah.
And my cousin actually got, I don't know how to say this in English, but it's el bumban.
Yeah, the smoke. The tear gas
Yes.
Bomb. Yeah.
It exploded next to his ear, and he was sleeping at that time. Mm-hmm. And the massacre happened at dawn. So they made sure, the RSF and other forces made sure to come there while everyone is sleeping and kill them while they're sleeping.
And I was also in Qatar during that time because it was Ramadan. And this is here where I come back to Qatar. And I remember it was like very early in the morning, a few hours after Al-Fajr prayer. And thank God we have Al Jazeera in Arabic that take the live streams of the people inside of the set in, and they stream them in the news, and we get to see literally everything that was happening there. And I think it comes in as part of resistance in how by that time they cut off the internet, and it's a moment where this stuff needs to be put on everywhere for people to know what is going in Sudan.
Exactly.
And this is the point of a shift in resistance in how we can use what we have to sort of spread knowledge, to let people know what is happening right now in Sudan. But sort of you want to take a step back and realize and understand who was the primary actor in that set in. Who are they? And how are they right now playing a significant role in the war in Sudan?
So when we're talking about the rapid support forces, it's very important to go back in time. And I think this is one of the things that's very important, is to recognize kind of how deeply tied they were to the former dictator and the former regime. And when we're talking about that, we're talking specifically about Darfur, because Darfur is this very important region in Sudan, in kind of like Western Sudan, and they have always been discriminated against, like, if we're talking about every single regime in Sudan, whether it's the good military, the bad military, every dictator, every person who ever ruled Sudan has discriminated against Darfur. And the RSF kind of were acting as border guards, and we'll talk about this in a bit, for the EU at that time. But they were primarily there to put down rebellions in Darfur. Because even though the rebellion in Sudan happened in Khartoum very late 2018-2019, they were always going on in Darfur against Omar al-Bashir, because he has always been brutal to them. So what he was doing is that he was kind of utilizing the ethnic divisions that were in Darfur at that time. They separate themselves. They call themselves, I don't want to get tribal, but they don't think they're African. They think they're Arab. So they think they're better than the others in Darfur. And so he kind of utilized that ethnic divide And he kind of recruited all of these rebels, these militiamen, and he put them together into one force called the Rapid Support Forces. Mm-hmm. At that time, they were called the Janjaweed, yes. And that's what we were calling them because they weren't like a military institution.
Yes.
They were just a group of fighters,
yes.
You know, that he just used to kill people in Darfur. And then, like, when he needed to actually legitimize them, it was... I don't remember exactly when, but it was kind of later that he finally made them into the Rapid Support Forces. And he brought them to Khartoum and he legitimized them. He made them a part of the army.
Yeah.
And he put Hemeti, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo,
yeah.
as the head or the leader of the Rapid Support Forces.
Yeah.
And for Omar al-Bashir, the Rapid Support Forces, when they came to Khartoum, they were serving as his personal protection force.
Yes.
So he was calling Hemeti Hemaiti, my protection. But it's very important to kind of like trace back this origin because when we're talking about the Rapid Support Forces, we're not talking about a legitimate military institution with any sort of like connection to Sudan.
Mm.
We're talking about a group of people who only know how to kill,
yes.
and who only know how to commit atrocities in the country. And when we kind of fast forward now, into the war that happened in April 15th, where the RSF attacked the military in Khartoum, in the capital of Sudan.
Mm.
We're talking about the same people who committed genocide, who killed more than 300,000 people in Darfur. The people who don't know anything, basically, but to kill.
Mm. And we also want to look at how these people... I don't know how to phrase that in English, but they are Murtazaqa, which meaning that they are not fully Sudanese.
Exactly.
They are a tribe that is extended in multiple parts of Africa and they came together. They don't know the culture of the country. They don't know the language of the country. And they just brought here to sort of massacre based on racial ideologies.
Yeah.
And it goes on into thinking... Okay, these people have been massacring the people in Darfur. Would they sort of have any mercy towards the people in Khartoum? Because it comes in just to a limited understanding of whatever is in front of me should not be living.
Mm, exactly. And
it goes on to how we've seen them killing in the massacre of the Set-In. And this is where I view it. In my opinion, this is the beginning of the war.
Mm.
And the war started there.
Yes.
Because even though we have these forces killing people in Sudan, nobody was even ever able to predict that these people are going to go ahead and start a war and continue doing even worse atrocities for the people in Sudan. And
I think that the question is now, like...
Yeah.
What are they fighting for?
Exactly.
And I think the answer to that is very easy because Hemeti himself and his brother, who, by the way, Hemeti, the head of the RSF, is not Sudanese.
Yep.
He's from Chad.
Yeah.
So it really baffles me when people say this war is Sudanese people fighting each other.
Yeah.
Hemeti himself is not Sudanese.
Mm.
What is he fighting for? He wants to establish his own family rule. He wants to establish a monarchy. People have been calling, people from his forces call him the prince. You know, he thinks he's a prince. He thinks he deserves to have this country as his own for his own tribe. To make it kind of like, because he aspires to kind of like rulers who have monarchies, who have family rule.
Yeah.
So that's what they're fighting for. But his forces are just fighting for the sake of fighting. Like they're killing for the sake of killing.
Mm.
And we see this is that, first of all, the majority of the RSF are not Sudanese.
Mm.
There are foreign mercenaries coming from Libya, coming from Chad, South Sudan, from the Niger, Ethiopia, all of the countries surrounding the region. These are people who just want to come in. They're being told, you can just come in, put in this uniform, we'll give you these weapons, take over. So they just go in and they can do whatever they want with impunity, meaning they don't have a real cause that they're fighting for. Mm. Hemeti is going to tell you we're here to bring democracy.
Yeah.
No, you're not here to bring democracy. Do your forces know you're here to bring democracy? Because when they enter, their primary interest is to loot, to take people's belongings, to kill people, to rape women, to steal.
Yeah.
And to just like any crime imaginable, they will do it.
Yeah. And I think as I'm here and knowing that this conversation is going for people, I think it becomes part of my duty to let people understand or to put people on the shoes of a Sudanese person who is living in his house in Sudan the day that the war started in May 2023. You are sitting at your home, you are sleeping, and then suddenly you are hearing shooting, and then your door get break. Some just soldier from random soldier from the Rapid Support Forces walks in, and he tells you, "Give me your money, give me your gold." He might shoot your dad. He would rape your sister, and he will tell you, "Get out of this house because we want to use it." This is not just when it. I wish I could lay it down more horrifying than this, but just imagining it or picturing it is such a painful reality that I had the right to be in my house.
Yeah.
And then someone not just walking into my house, they kill the people in my house, they kill me, they rape the woman in my house, and they kick me out of it, and they rob me from out of my own money, and they tell me, just go out on the street.
I think if we
going out on the street is even dangerous.
Exactly. I think we would need a whole other episode to talk about RSF crimes.
I know.
Because it's very difficult to get through everything.
Yeah.
And like just 2 weeks ago, they poisoned the whole area.
Yeah.
And they killed more than 500 people for no reason.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult for people to comprehend that these are people who are not, they don't have an interest in Sudan other than doing all these things and like getting as much as they can out of it. And the extent to which their crimes are horrific is unimaginable because they don't stop at anything. And I think one of the reasons is because they never get punished. They never get, in fact, they get rewarded.
Yes.
When they invade a new village or a new city and they rape all the women there, they kidnap all the women there. There's literally a slave market for women in Sudan right now. Sudanese women are being stolen and sold in markets as sex slaves.
Yeah.
These people are also recruiting children, which just means they're stealing, they're kidnapping 14, 12-year-old boys to fight for them. And these boys are also subjected to sexual violence by these people.
Yeah.
So I think just what we're trying to get to here is, and I think it's very important at this point, that we recognize that it's a militia.
Yes.
And it's very frustrating to me when I go into even a Jazeera in English and they're reporting it as still a paramilitary. Sudan as a country and the Sudanese government, the Sudanese transitional government, classified the RSF as a militia a whole year ago.
Yes.
However, the UN did not.
Yes.
There is no country that has spoken out against the RSF in a way that is not, that is clear and direct and pointing the finger at them. It's always very vague.
Yeah.
It's like paramilitary fighters kill 50 people in a village. Okay, yes. Who killed the 50 people?
And that gave me like a flashback from an event that I watched that I went to in Georgetown this week. It was Food as a Weapon, a Legal Perspective on Palestine. I remember there was Dr. Michael Fakhri, who is a UN rapporteur. And I remember on that panel, he discussed the role of international law and accountability. And I liked a very good point that he mentioned on how the international law and corporate organizations, they intentionally makes it hard for people to hold a group or a state accountable of something. So it becomes a point of where it's almost impossible for us to see this group being held accountable of what they are doing and also getting them into the punishment.
Yeah.
So for how long the war in Sudan been going? Or for how long has it been since the massacre in the set-in of the army forces? Yet, we did not see any action done from international law to do anything towards this. So it becomes a point of a dead end. Who am I going to be relying on into ensuring that this is not going to happen again. If the international law held the RSF accountable for the set in massacre they have done, the war in Sudan would not been happening right now.
Yeah.
Because they would have been held accountable for their women and they would have been stopped. But yeah. Then you are letting this go on.
Mm.
And this is a sort of a very painful thing to realize, is that who am I going to rely on if no one has my back?
And I think at this people, like Sudanese people, are recognizing that they cannot rely on anyone from the international community to save them.
Yeah.
And the international community, the UN and all of these institutions that always talk about, oh, we need to find a solution.
Mm.
Their solution is always sanctioning people. Or like they refuse to look at the primary aggressor. They refuse to recognize the RSF as literally a terrorist entity that must be eradicated for peace to be achieved in Sudan.
Yeah.
Instead, they're opting for kind of like calling it a civil war.
Yes.
Calling it a proxy war, calling it all of these things that mischaracterize the situation on the ground.
Yeah.
So Sudanese people are like, we have nobody to help us through this. We have to get ourselves through it.
Yeah. And I think this sort of moves us to...
It moves us towards what the war is.
Yeah.
And what we view it as Sudanese people. Is it a civil war? Aya, do you think the war in Sudan is a civil war?
That's a very funny question, because if I was asked back there... when the set-in massacre happened, I would definitely say, okay, yeah, we do recognize how, you know, all the forces in Sudan, including the army, had a hand in the massacre of the set-in. But then right now, as in when the war started like 2 months and I get my family is sitting down looking horrified and I ask what's going on, they tell me, oh, the Rapid Support Militia invaded my house. In Sudan, the house that my family put in their efforts to build in years, and I lived in that house, and all of my memories are that in that house, is invaded by the militia, and of course, its stuff is going to be stolen. And I'm not going to come out there saying that, no, it's a civil war, both sides are bad. We understand the mistakes that have been done by the military throughout the war, but eventually... we can clearly see how the RSF over there doing whatever they want in the most horrifying methods. And yet people get to say that it's a civil war.
Yeah. And it is such an oversimplification of the war in Sudan.
Yes, yeah.
Because first of all, it doesn't account for the genocide and happening in that form that we already talked about.
Yeah.
People being buried in mass graves simply for being from a certain tribe.
Yes.
That's one thing that's not accounted for.
Yeah.
It doesn't account for the settler colonialism that's happening.
Yeah.
Literally, RSF walking in and living in Khartoum. They've taken over all of the houses in Khartoum and they're just living there.
Yeah.
They're bringing their families in from Chad, from all of these other places to live with them in our houses. Mm. It doesn't even account for the external support that the RSF is getting.
Yeah.
And that's what we can get at here.
Yeah. And I just want to add one point before I move into the support of the RSF, is that when someone comes up and says Sudan war is a civil war, and someone who has a very high position, someone is supposed to know enough about politics, I would immediately assume that this person is extremely uneducated.
Yes.
Because it's okay, number one, we have the war in Darfur, who's where these forces have been designed to go and kill people with the racial motivations. And then you have the war in Sudan, where we see how the crimes on crimes on crimes on crimes being primarily committed by the RSF. And you go ahead and said, oh, it's a civil war. Let's split this crimes into two parts.
I think it would have been true that this is a civil war, and it would have been a much favorable situation for Sudanese people if the army and the RSF were simply fighting each other.
Yeah.
That's just not the case.
Mm.
the RSF is not fighting the army only. Mm. The RSF is fighting every single person in Sudan. Yes. And they're targeting everybody in the country.
Yeah.
It is a massive mischaracterization. Even calling it a proxy war is not even accurate.
Yes.
Because you cannot call the Sudanese army a proxy.
Mm.
Because the Sudanese army is a legitimate institution that has its own motivation for going into this war.
Yes.
It is not being perpetuated by someone else, just as the RSF is, to commit all of these crimes.
Yeah, and of course, like, you get to see, okay, you are a person who's not Sudanese, and you definitely have any motives in Sudan, or would you carry a gun and go kill anyone? Well, of course, I'm getting a lot of money from it.
Exactly.
And who's giving that money? We have our main beloved country, the UAE, who are over there having their eyes on the Sudanese gold for I don't know how many years, because... We have to also go back to Omar al-Bashir's part and be like, and how he also designed these forces, not only for the war in Sudan, to have their eyes on Iwanat Mountain, which is the gold mountain that is shared between Sudan, Libya, and also Egypt.
Mm.
And it is there where the UAE be like, you know, let's be, you know, some friends, and I can get to take your gold for the cheapest price that you can ever think of, and I'm going to give you arms. And we also have to put in consideration how some countries profit from wars.
Yeah.
This is the UAE's business, is that the moment there is a war in some country, this is the moment of them having profit out of it. Let me give you weapons, and you, in return, give me a lot of gold.
Yeah, and I think it really puts it into perspective when you think about where is the cheapest gold ever in the Gulf.
Yeah.
It's in the UAE. The UAE has this massive gold market, and it's all stolen Sudanese gold.
Mm.
These people don't even, the RSF and the heads of the RSF, they don't understand the value that gold has. So they're just simply giving it away to the UAE.
Mm.
The UAE gets to establish itself as they have this large gold market.
Mm.
And I think it's very ironic that we all have to be killed and we all have to go through all of this just for the UAE to profit out of our gold.
Yeah. And it becomes sort of also painful to see other global South countries just watching and sort of refusing to have any interference in that, because it also goes back to the point of who am I going to rely on? No, international law is bad. Global South is bad. What about the EU?
I think
also bad.
I think it's very funny to me personally when I see anybody from the EU come out and talk about the war in Sudan, considering the hand they had in making the RSF what it is today.
Yeah.
Let's just go back a bit. Omar al-Bashir, Sudan was kind of blacklisted for a very long time.
Mm.
And Omar al-Bashir always strove to have like good relations with the Europeans and with the Americans and et cetera. So he decided that he will take this, the RSF, and at that time it was still not the RSF, but he decided that he wanted to use them as border guards. Now, the EU called this the Khartoum process, where we're going to care for all of the refugees. We're going to give them safe haven. We're going to make sure that they're protected when they're trying to get to Europe.
Yep.
The real reason why they wanted to have these people is because they don't want the refugees to get to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're talking about Sudan's geographical location, you have refugees coming from all over the continent to pass through Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And they go through Sudan to get to the other side, to get to Europe. And so Sudan is in a very critical location. And so it's important for the EU to have control over who gets to go through Sudan.
Mm.
And to do this, they had no issue talking to Omar al-Bashir, giving him millions of dollars. And then Omar al-Bashir himself would then take all of this money that he gets from the EU.
Mm.
I think it was like 100 or 200 million euros.
Mm.
And he, of course, he invests it into his militia and makes it into what it is today. The RSF had been receiving money from the EU for a long time. And in fact, a lot of the weaponry and the things that they got from them were used against protesters in the massacre of April of that happened in 2019.
Yes.
So the EU, we cannot rely on any sort of like international outsider institution, because they always have their own agendas. They always have their own motivations for any war happening in the global south.
Yeah.
And so I think there's this issue with the fact that the UAE itself is allied and is sort of an ally with all of these countries in the West. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about like America, we're talking about the UK and France as well. They get their oil from there. So they're not going to jeopardize their relationship with them for us. Mm. And that's where it gets to a point where, like, of course, the UN is not going to have a good response to the war in Sudan. Mm. The UN is also going to be sort of like an impartial sort of, even though they understand the involvement of the UAE, they're not going to do anything about it.
Yeah.
And I guess now we get to like media coverage. Aya, what do you think the biggest issue with media coverage is now?
So it's surprisingly, people get to see that, you know, how Western media can still has the possibility of give me the right information, you know, because, you know, what they are seeing is, okay, yeah, they're going to give me everything that I get to know about the war, about the whole world.
Mm.
But then I completely avoid Western media.
Yeah.
I completely avoid international media because they serve as nothing of what I get to see. And I realized that when my country itself started to go into political complications, and I live in Sudan and I'm a person literally in the scene, and I get to see something and I get to see the Western media saying a completely different thing. So I'm not going to go ahead and be like, let me read about my own country, about a source that doesn't know anything about my country.
Exactly.
And this is where, like, I personally prefer to use more of a regional media, such as Al Jazeera, to the Arabic Al Jazeera, to follow up on what is happening in Sudan. And I would like to highlight one thing is that it's completely unfortunate to see such international universities or American universities like Georgetown, who exist in Qatar, choose to still use Western media as a source to represent their political stance. And unfortunately, we get to see that in events done in Georgetown University, labeling the war in Sudan as a power struggle. And I'm happy to hear from some of the faculties here in the university is that how the adaptation of the Western media is also embedded in the in Georgetown University in Qatar. And I think it dissolves its uniqueness of being a university in Qatar. You have one of the best and the biggest media streamers in here, and you still choose to go for something that is very vague and also, you know, not really reliable.
Yeah, and I think it's also just like from the point of trying so hard to be neutral that you alienate a whole group of people who have been screaming for literally years at this point for some change.
Yeah.
I heard the both sides thing so many times that it's become very difficult for me to even hear about it.
Yes.
And the thing about Western media is that they make sure that they have so many different ways to say the same thing.
Yeah.
So civil war. War between two generals, both sides are bad, power struggle, and I can name five more. And it all just kind of implies the same thing. There is nothing you can do to help Sudan. You should not support anybody in Sudan. Just pray for them. And if you can, donate. That's the sort of narrative they're running with. And it's so harmful, especially for me as a Sudanese person, to hear my people screaming for some support, you know. The RSF is killing us. They're massacring us. Please sanction them. Please classify them as a militia in the UN. Please stop. At least don't meet with them in secret as the UK has done last April or as the America, Tom Perriello, the US envoy to Sudan, keeps doing, meeting with the RSF and kind of giving them legitimization. That's the only thing we're asking for. And somehow that's very difficult. And I think the way that we speak about the war also contributes to that. To call it a war between two generals is to kind of alienate a whole group of people who are telling you something different. So now I will pose this question to you. If we're not going to look at outside countries for support, if we're not going to look at the media or the dominant media or even international institutions, who are we going to look at for the war to end, and who should we support for the war in Sudan to end? since we cannot depend on other countries mm. for the war to end, we mm. cannot depend on media to give the real truth about what's happening in Sudan. Mm. And we cannot even depend on international institutions because they always sort of like mischaracterize. Mm. Who should we depend on and who should we support for this war to reach an end finally?
I think based on our conversation now, we get to seek to look for the least worst, which is the army. Mm. In the case that we don't really want the militia out there to be ruling the country, it becomes mm. a nightmare for every single Sudanese civilian that at some point they hear that the RSF has won the war. I think it's the point where Sudan should stop
mm.
being even existent mm. from the... It's literally the downfall of the Kingdom of Sudan.
Yes.
And it's I hope that we never get to see this happening. I hope I never get to hear that, because I don't want some terror group to be over there taking over my country. And since we have got into that point, I think it is really very important to highlight the importance of recognizing this issue
mm.
and to the importance of letting other people know about this issue. Because it becomes very painful to see Sudan being recognized as a civil war. And because it's recognized as a civil war, it becomes very undermined.
Mm.
Because, and I heard that from people telling that to my face, is that, why are your people killing each other? Oh. And yeah, I was like, no.
Me too.
it's never that way. And even if it's a civil war, because let's say if it's a civil war, does that really make it less important for people to talk about it?
Mm.
So it becomes under the narrative that if a group is killing each other, they're not that significant because they are, I don't know, like...
Yeah.
It's not
what would
important.
I do about
what
it?
What would I do about mm. it? You know, stop fighting, shake hands. It's
a very lazy way to look at the war.
It's a very lazy way to look for the war, and it just tells you how you are shallow minded.
Mm.
Excuse my language, but it is really that, okay, you are looking at the two parts that are playing a significant role, but what about the results? What about the people?
Yes,
Sudan is the worst humanitarian crisis that ever happened on this earth,
mm.
and we have millions of people. Displaced, millions and millions of people are starved. These are numbers that never been witnessed
mm.
throughout history. And yet you are sitting there saying, no, it's just a civil war. Why should I care? And
yeah.
I think it's very painful. And seeing that narrative happening in Georgetown as well. Mm. And it becomes very painful as a student to see how the war is undermined
mm.
and how the war is... even when the war decided to be represented in Sudan, it represented under false labels.
Yeah, and it makes me very upset that people are not willing to kind of read up.
Mm.
And even when they do read up, they're going to look at kind of like the first three articles. And the mm. first three articles are going to be like the New York Post and Washington something.
Or a Wikipedia.
Or Wikipedia. And it's like the most terrible yeah. news sources that you yeah. can find. So, but kind of going back to like, what do the Sudanese people think about all this while this is going through, and what is their solution?
Mm.
As a Sudanese person, even though I do have a lot of disdain for the Sudanese army as an institution for literally everything in the past 30 years, I think that like just the logical sequence of events would be this: for the Sudanese army to win the war, and then for then the army itself to be reformed. And then for us mm. to find a way to make a civilian-led government. Mm. I think the first step towards that is for the RSF to be eradicated.
Yes.
And it, the other thing is that, what is the army? The army is not a militia. The mm. army is a real institution that is mm. the backbone of the country.
Mm.
If the RSF wins the war, there will not be an army. There will not be a government. Mm. There will just be a militia ruling a country. That's going to be a failed state.
Mm.
And Sudan is not going to exist anymore. Yes. For all we know, he's going to name it the Dagalo Empire or whatever. And he's going to make it into his own country. And I think, like, going back to the revolution, even Muhammad al-Siddiq, who is like an icon Allah irhamu, he was killed by the RSF. Mm. He said that this war is a war of existence, mm. meaning Sudan is not going to exist if we don't fight for it. Mm. And I think that's one of the most important things, even because he called for civilians to join the Sudanese army, mm. to recruit, to enlist themselves into the army, and to become to fight with the army to liberate their houses, to protect their children, their sisters, to just literally just live, mm. By joining the army. So mm. it's very clear who you're supposed to support in this situation, yeah. As someone who's not in the country. Mm. And even just considering that army-controlled areas in Sudan today get aid, even though aid is very minimal when it gets to Sudan.
Yes.
I think there's a shortage of like $500 million in aid, if not more. It does get to those areas. People in some areas in Umdurman, they're living, mm. you know, and that is an army controlled area. You see life going back to these areas, mm. because for the simple reason that there is no RSF in the area. Mm. Shendi, Port Sudan, all these other places. Yeah, yes, Somalia. Life is difficult,
yeah.
but there is life. Mm. If you go anywhere else where the RSF is taking over, there is no life. There is no sort of dignified life you can live, mm. as long as the RSF exists. Mm. So the line of logic, since we cannot rely on literally any international institution, mm. or any other country to help us, mm. we're going to rely on our army, mm. even though it is an institution that we have marched against, mm. at some point or another.
Yes. And I think over here it's a good note to end this episode. And what she's saying, editor, don't make this the end.
Okay, it's not the end.
Okay, and I think it's also really important, since we are highlighting advocacy right now,
mm.
is to see what sources can we go back to, mm. to learn about the war. And I would say that social media, it has its significant role, mm. in how to represent this war. And I would highly recommend to visit accounts on Instagram such as Ana Sudani.
Mm.
And this account gives sources both in English and Arabic.
Mm.
And it literally get videos from those who are living in the moment. And, you know, the account is active 24/7.
Yes.
You get to see a post every single minute. And it shows you exactly what's been going on in Sudan. And I think this is very a good way, or a good point for people to start getting exposed to reliable resources.
I think there are some accounts on Twitter as well. I don't have the names, but mm. I think when you follow Sudanese people on the ground, mm. it becomes very easy, because there are Sudanese people who know English, who report speaking English,
mm.
and they're the most reliable source you can get, because yes. that's literally as the most like objective news you'll get,
mm.
With no like distortions.
Mm.
There is also an account called Walid Kosti on Instagram, mm. also very authentic news coming right from Sudan.
Mm.
But I think I'll give this question to you, Aya. What do you think people can do to support Sudan other than kind of donate and pray for it?
I think it's right now, since we have all of these platforms, you know, and right now as a student in Georgetown or student in any other university, you have the ability to raise your voice.
Mm.
And I think it's a point of that, if you did not learn about the war, go and learn about the war. If you did not speak about the war, go and speak mm. about the war. Have the more recognition the war gets, it's where we can get people to pray,
mm.
And ask Allah or ask God for sort of help, mm. and to relieve this pain. And also we can get people to donate, to give as much
mm.
in their capacity to help people over there.
Yeah.
And the more you get to learn about the war as well, it would shift your understanding from it being just a war between two generals to something that goes bigger into, there's a side that is people that are supporting, and they are people who are still in need.
Mm.
You have to look for those in need, because this is where the effect of your understanding will reflect.
Yes.
So I think this is a point that people should start with until the war ends. and hopefully we get to have the liberty that Sudanese people are wishing to have.
Like, Sudanese people don't deserve to die in the dark. I think, like, the easiest way for us to point the finger in the right direction is if we're all collectively doing it at the same time. People are doing excellent work for Palestine when it comes to pointing the finger at Israel, at all of these international actors who are contributing to the suffering in Sudan. People don't do that for Sudan. And I think once we get to the point where people are motivated enough to care about those people who are dying there and to also point the finger in the right direction towards the RSF, towards the UAE, and towards the UN for its for still not classifying the RSF as a militia. I think that's where we get to real change.
And I feel like it also becomes a responsibility for us, especially that we are SFS students or School of Foreign Service students, is that I make sure that I recognize every atrocity that's happening around the world, because once I learn about Palestine, I go and learn about Sudan, I go and learn about Congo, I go and learn about Yemen, Uyghurs in China. Every single place has an atrocity, and it becomes in our responsibility to learn about it. And of course, not from Western resources or you know, media platforms where they just gives you whatever information that you get to take. And I think on that note, it becomes, you know, And on that note, And I think on that note, we can end our episode here. Thank you so much for tuning in with us. And we hope to come back and bring more content about Sudan.
Thank you so much for listening. And this was the first step towards change.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of GAQ Speaks. We hope you've gained valuable insights and inspirations from our conversation today. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to follow us on our Instagram page at GAQ_speaks, and be sure to leave a review on Spotify to show your support.